Hi, everyone. I'm Terry Hutchinson. Welcome to the Interpreter Insights podcast. For this episode, we're going to have a special guest, Thomas Grover. He's an attorney from Las Vegas, and he gave a paper at the Mormon History Association this past weekend where he talked about a real intriguing event in the history of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Let me remind you that the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. And we invite you to see what the Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast app. Because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. We're going to continue our survey of the volumes of the Interpreter Foundation Journal. Volume 6 has 11 articles. In the introduction, and nearly all the introductions are written by Dan Peterson, with a couple of exceptions, and Dan is the president and one of the original founders of the Interpreter Foundation. It's called The Modest But Important End of Apologetics. And in this article, he says something very useful at the end, and I just wanted to read that to you. Apologetics is limited, both in appeal and scope. Most people aren't interested in it or in the issues with which it deals, and many, for those or other reasons, don't need it. We should be modest about what apologetics can do. Our arguments, no matter how learned and no matter how sound, can't force belief. We can't reason people into faith. Reasoned argument can nourish and protect a seed and can even prepare the soil for the sowing of a seed, but it can't cause a seed to germinate where none has been planted. Faith isn't purely intellectual. And for many people, it's not an intellectual matter at all. See, for example, 1 Corinthians 12:8-9. But sound apologetic arguments can perhaps help clear away objections that interfere with faith in both believers and unbelievers. They can persuade investigators or wavering members of the church to regard the claims of Mormonism as what William James called a live option rather than a dead one. In other words, to give faith serious consideration. This is a relatively humble role, a modest end, or telos, but it can, at least for some, be vital. And even more broadly, faithful scholarship can explain the value and richness that believers see in the gospel, the depth and insight that are to be found in the scriptures, the meaning that a life of discipleship confers. This journal, Interpreter, was established slightly more than a year ago to further those aims. I'm grateful for all who have contributed to its launch and who have made its continued flourishing possible. The next one is a review of Adam S. Miller's Rube Goldberg Machines, Essays in Mormon Theology. And it's a review by Robert F. Smith of a series of essays by Adam Miller, who is noted for what he calls Mormon theology. That has its pros and cons, and many other interpreter commentators have spoken about that kind of topic over the years, and we'll get to those in due course. But this was a very positive review of Adam's book. Then a very brief note on Family Structure in Mosiah 2 and 5 by Stephen D. Ricks. A little bit of a scholarly article, but an important note. Then we're followed by another article by Lou Midgley, Multiple Reformations and a Deeply Divided House. This is a fairly positive review of Diarmaid McCulloch, The Reformation. And I ran across Diarmaid's work when I was doing my daily book reviews in St. George on the radio. And I really appreciated that book too. But for those of you who like this, this is an excellent introduction, very well written and very accessible to the general reader. It's called The Reformation, came out in 2004. So even though it's been a few years, it's still an excellent book. That inspired me to get another excellent book on the Reformation by Yale. It's called Reformations, The Early Modern World, 1450 through 1650, and it's by Carlos M. N. Iyer. I have to confess, I like that better than Diarmaid's book. The following week, Professor Midgley gave us another book review. It's a review of Mark A. Knoll, Protestantism, A Very Short Introduction by Oxford University Press. This is a little series. The Book of Mormon is in it. Richard Bushman has done one on Mormonism. Then another very brief article by Stephen L. Olson. It's called Peter's Tears. In the abstract, Peter's denial of Christ is one of only about 24 events reported in all 4 of the Gospels. 3 of the accounts conclude by Peter's weeping. This paper examines the antecedents, possible motivations, and long-term consequences of this crisis in Peter's life as recorded in the scriptural text and considers its application for all disciples of the Savior. The next article is by Gary P. Gillum, and it's called Written to the Lamanites, Understanding the Book of Mormon Through Native Culture and Religion. Latter-day Saints have always been encouraged to seek the truth wherever it can be found. With the Book of Mormon being written especially to the Lamanites, we can assume that the more we know about Lamanite and Native American culture, the more we can understand, appreciate, and gain insights as we read that inspired scripture. In this article, the writer has compared examples from Native American culture and history to what we read in the Book of Mormon and experience as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Most importantly, as we read through the eyes of a Native American, we can appreciate the divinity and authenticity of the Book of Mormon. Since Joseph Smith could not have known Native American culture and history in the way it is described herein. Then there's one by John W. Welch, Toward a Mormon Jurisprudence. The following article was published in the Regent University Law Review, pages 79 through 103 of the 2008-2009 volume. The article is reprinted here by permission without any substantive modifications. Because law reviews are not easily available on the web or elsewhere to most readers, I'm pleased to give wider exposure to this first foray into the idea of a Mormon jurisprudence. Regent University is an evangelical Christian institution. So then there's a fairly long preface about what this article is about, what the talk was about. It's been followed up with a series of articles on a similar topic that's been put into a recent book by Nathan Oman, which I'm sure we'll be talking about sometime on the Interpreter Foundation. Then we have Misunderstanding Mormonism in the Mormonizing of America. That's by Craig Foster. It's a review of a book, The Mormonizing of America, How the Mormon Religion Became a Dominant Force in Politics, Entertainment, and Pop Culture. The Mormonizing of America by Stephen Mansfield has been touted as a solid, impartial look at Mormon history and doctrine. Unfortunately, on closer examination, the book is seriously lacking both in substance and impartiality, and the article discusses the book's numerous problems. Then there is a very interesting article by Gregory Smith. It's about 50 pages. And it's actually a review essay, and I've done a couple of these in the past, where you not only do one book review, but you review several on a theme. And it's actually pretty fun when you do it. But this one is a review of several books, and I won't list them all, on evolutionary biography. Finally, we have Stretching to Find the Negative, Gary Bergera's review of Joseph Smith's Polygamy, History, and Theology. At an Author Meets Critic Sunstone Symposium on August 2, 2013, Gary Bergera devoted over 90% of his 15-minute review to criticize my 1,500-page, 3-volume Joseph Smith's Polygamy, History, and Theology. And I should mention that this article is written by Brian C. Hales. The article responds to several of the disagreements outlined by Bergera that on closer inspection appear as straw men. It also addressed are the tired arguments buoyed by carefully selected documentation he advanced, supporting that John C. Bennett learned of polygamy from Joseph Smith, the Fanny Alger-Joseph Smith relationship was adultery, and the prophet practiced sexual polyandry. This article attempts to provide greater balance by including new evidences published for the first time in the 3 volumes, but ignored by Bergera. And these new documents and observations empower readers to expand their understanding beyond the time-worn reconstructions referenced in Bergera's critical review. And I've got to tell you that Brian Hales' Joseph Smith's Polygamy, no matter how you feel about the subject, is such an important reference work. I don't think we can sing its praises highly enough. So that being said, that wraps up our survey of Volume 6 for 2013, and we'll do another one in our next episode. Everyone, we want to welcome our special guest to this episode of the podcast, Thomas Grover. He's an attorney in Las Vegas. I ran across Tom several years ago. He says it was 10. I think it might have been 15 or 20, but who knows? We had a case together for a brief minute and went down to his office, and I immediately recognized he was a fellow Latter-day Saint, which is always welcome in Las Vegas. And we just had a good time. And then I kind of lost track of him. And recently, Facebook gave me a prompt. You might you know, be interested in this guy. I looked at it, and all of a sudden, he's talking my language. He's getting ready to do a paper at the Mormon History Association meetings, which this year happened to be in Las Vegas. And so I invited Tom on the program. And when I first contacted you, Tom texted me and said, I love the interpreter. So why don't we start by having you introduce yourself to our audience. Tell us a little bit about your background, your educational background, your professional background, and then kind of how you ran across interpreter and what you appreciate about it.
Sure. I originally from Logan, Utah, and attended Utah State. I'm a fourth generation Aggie. After graduating from Utah State, I worked at KVNU for 3 years. That's the news talk station in Logan, and did a drive time show from 4 to 6 every night. I attended law school at the University of Nebraska, graduated from there in 2011. And then I've been doing trust and estate litigation here in Las Vegas since then. And that's been the focus of my practice. And so that's kind of what led me to the Howard Hughes paper. We'll talk about that in a moment. But my interest in interpreter kind of traces back to Daniel Peterson. Ben Park in his YouTube video sometimes talks about the back in the 90s, if you're a missionary, there were tapes floating around. They went viral before things went viral. And there were a few from Daniel Peterson that I really loved. One of them was a lecture that he gave, I think, at church headquarters on Islam. That was the first time I ever learned about Islam. And he presented it in such a really engaging way that was really respectful to Islam. It wasn't an attack by any means, but drawing some interesting comparisons and contrasting their faith with our faith. And obviously, he's done a lot since then. That was 25 years ago. I just have enjoyed a lot of the Old Testament stuff. The conversation you recently had with Kevin Christensen was helpful. You know, the Old Testament is so challenging because there's so much context to take in. And I feel overwhelmed by that sometimes. And so I appreciate stuff that makes things accessible without being overwhelming. And then also I like it when, I feel like it's helping me better understand things instead of getting lost in the weeds about arcane things, especially with the Old Testament. I feel overwhelmed by the Old Testament. So that's my thought, my feeling about that.
Well, that's good. You know, Kevin has been a co-host with me for several years. And as I mentioned before, I originally ran across Kevin's work when he started talking about Margaret Barker. He did an occasional paper for Farms about all of her work. And so I started looking at it, and it totally changed the way I read the scriptures, especially the Old Testament. And so I've always appreciated his take on it, as well as others that we've got. And it's obviously just really beneficial. But it's interesting that you would have run across a tape of Dan Peterson back in the day. I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that. So tell us, as we're recording, they just finished the Mormon History Association meeting there in Las Vegas. So tell us a little about that. That's the first one you've been able to attend. How was that? What did you like best? What presentations may have stood out in your mind, and how did you kind of decide to present at this one, at this meeting?
Well, there are, as you know, many LDS conferences on scriptures and culture and history, and for years I've always seen them announced, and then had something come up in my work schedule that prevented it. And so they came, it just happens to be the MHA came here this year, and I blocked it out to go down. And it was really a great experience. There's a pretty wide spectrum of views and approaches, but I was just so impressed at how supportive and inclusive everybody was. I never felt any tensions, even when people were pushing back on ideas. And I really enjoyed that. There were a couple of other presentations that focused on Las Vegas and Clark County history. And one of them that I thought was really impressive was a presentation on Kaolin, Nevada. And that was a small colony just north of St. Thomas. And I know you lived in St. George, Terry, and so you may be familiar with the story of St. Thomas, that it was abandoned over some tax issues and then later submerged in Lake Mead. Kaolin was a post-Reed Smoot hearing colony settled by the church by Armenian converts. And these Armenian converts were in the throes of political violence, and I don't understand the full context of that back home. And they asked the church to be able to come out and start their own colony. And the church initially said no, apparently, according to this presentation, saying, you know, we've gone through these Reed Smoot hearings and we're just not doing that anymore. But they made one last exception. And so this was the last Mormon colony in the U.S. And they came out, and it was a rough go of it for them. But to me, hearing stories like that is really faith affirming, because you have people that were determined to get here and didn't let the circumstances at home or even being told no by the church stop them. And they got here and they did it. And they went to a tough spot and made the best of it. You know, the Moapa
Yeah,
Valley.
I can't think of anything that would be harder to make a living at in those days.
Yeah. You got to be tough to farm in the Moapa Valley, even now. That's just
Yeah,
not
that's
an
true.
easy walk. And they did
Yeah.
it. And so I just have tremendous respect for them. And I loved learning about that and many other things. You know, one of the great things about Mormon history is it is a bottomless well of stories like that, of ordinary people making extraordinary sacrifices for their faith. And it's such a blessing to be able to learn about things like that. And so I appreciate what you're doing, what these historians from different universities or independent historians were doing at MHA and different groups. I think we're in a golden age of being able to share these stories and information, and it's a great blessing to be able to consume it.
Yeah, we're also able to. In fact, just a week ago, the Interpreter Foundation had a conference on the small plates of Lehi. I don't know. I would hope we'll see a volume on that. It'd probably be two volumes. But last year, when they did the Abraham volume, it came out right away. Like, it came out, they had the conference in early May, and the book was out in August, in time for the
Wow.
Interpreter Foundation birthday. I don't know if that'll be the case here, but they're on a pretty tight timeline, so we'll see. But you did a presentation yourself, so how did you go about doing that process?
Well, when I saw MHA was coming to town, I just felt like it was a once in a lifetime intersection of three things that I know a little bit about and am passionate about: probate law, which is what I practice, Las Vegas history,
You've
and
put me
then
to
Mormon
sleep
history.
already. With the probate law thing, Tom, you've put me to sleep.
I hope that doesn't stay true for the rest of our visit. But
Exactly.
basically, it's, you know, if you say what's the one case at the intersection of probate law, Mormon history, and Las Vegas history, there's only one. It's the Howard Hughes dispute, and so that's kind of how I picked it. It's just it fit me like a glove to go and take a look at that, I thought. And
So, tell us about your presentation. Tell us about the article itself, which is unpublished.
yep.
Okay, you've kind of started it, and it looks like it's something that can go in a lot of different directions, and there's a heck of a lot more to say about it based on the record that the voluminous record that you and I have talked about off the air, but we'll let the listeners know.
Well, yeah, let me mention what the record is. I was able to obtain from the court here the record for the Mormon will dispute. And it's a little over 5,000 pages, which sounds like a lot, but you know, it really isn't, given the gravity of the litigation. If this were litigated now, I think the record would be substantially larger than it was back then. And so I went through that, and as I went through, I really wanted to make my presentation about not just the litigation generally, but I wanted to center the focus on Mormon identity and also on the choices that the church made institutionally. which ended up both being really, I think, interesting. There is more that can be done with this, and I hope to do that. At MHA, we've got a 20-minute presentation, and they were really gracious to allow me to present, given that I'd never even attended before. And that was nice of them, and I'm grateful for that. But I'd like to probably build it out a little bit more. The thing that I tried to focus on in my paper were really two things. I felt like I could cover two dimensions in the time allotted. One is a focus on the choices that the church made early on when this will showed up out of nowhere, and the way that shaped the identity of the document and the litigation in a way that tied the church and our faith generally to the will, even though the church as an institution wasn't a combatant in the litigation. And then second, building out of that, there was what I think is a really fascinating attack on the judge that oversaw this trial. His name was Keith Hayes. He's a Latter-day Saint living here in Las Vegas, well regarded in the community both before and after the trial. But there was a point where some very serious accusations were made against him that he was biased because of his faith and was going to put his finger on the scales of justice so that the church could receive a share of this estate from Howard Hughes. And so that's what I tried to focus on, were those two different things. But there's a lot more in terms of the church's role that I think could be built out in developing this a little bit more.
Okay, so let's back up a minute. Talk about the will itself, how it got in the hands of the church. Why is the church even involved in this in the first place?
It is such, even now looking back on it, it's a bizarre story. And the thing that I like to think about when talking about this, or when I was putting this presentation together, is I really tried to think about what would I have thought if I were in the church office building and this will shows up out of nowhere. You and I have the benefit now of knowing what the evidence is and the theories are as to how it ended up at church headquarters, but its appearance there is just so bizarre and unexpected. It's really hard to
Well, I
overstate
don't think
that.
it could happen today because, for one thing, I dropped off a package for the first presidency once for a friend of mine. I didn't get through the front door. I mean, it was like in that building where the 12 and the first presidency had that little administration building there. They have giants there at the front door. There's no way. It's certainly not going to be just popped up on the desk of the secretary of the first presidency. Is just, you know, but it was a different time then. I don't think it could
Well,
happen now.
I would hope not. Not to, I won't spoil it yet, but later the person who did drop off the will said that they walked into the church office building and said, "I need to go see President Kimball." And the person who was at the concierge or the help desk or whatever said, "Oh yeah, he's up on the 25th floor." So he just went up to the floor where President Kimball's office was, which, as you said, is unthinkable now. And so,
Well, that
I,
reminds me, though, Tom, let me interrupt you if I could.
yeah.
During that period of time, I remember I was about 15, 16 years old, and we went and visited President Kimball with Elder Bangeter, who there's another Elder Bangeter now, but this was Elder Grant Bangeter back in the day. He was in our ward, and so we were able to go up and visit, and the administration building, the little guy where they all are normally, was under serious renovation. And so they moved the entire first presidency office to the 25th floor of the tall administration of the tall office building. So, yeah, if he just said, I got to go up and make this or whatever, maybe that's how it happened. But that's a good point that you make. It was on the 25th floor. It wasn't in the little building because it's much harder to get in the little building.
Yes, as it should be.
Yeah.
Anyway, so late in the afternoon, a guy named Daniel Himmon comes back from a staff meeting and he finds an envelope on his desk. So this is April 27th, 1976, and Howard Hughes had died, I think, on the 5th of that month, just a few weeks earlier. And in the interim, over these weeks, there's already a frenzy going on where people are looking for a will. They are breaking into his properties where he has archived documents down in LA. That happened. There's already a temporary person in LA that's been appointed to take care of his California properties. And so there's already a lot of activity. And this Daniel Himen guy comes back, and this envelope's on his desk, and it's addressed to President Kimball. And he does not open it. He takes it down to Nola Allaman, who opens President Kimball's mail, and she opens the envelope, and there's another envelope inside of it. And they say, inadvertently opens the second envelope. I don't know exactly what that means, but she pulls out three pages, and it's a document that purports to be the handwritten will of Howard Hughes. She then takes that to D. Arthur Haycock, who I think is a kind of a well-known figure, who was President Kimball's secretary, and then it's presented to President Kimball. Their initial concern after getting rid of over the shock is this a hoax? And it's not a concern about are we going to not get money that this document says. They were very worried about being associated with a hoax. And so the next morning they call in Wilford Curtin Jr., who founded Curtin and McConkie, and they show this document to him, and in his reaction is the same. Curtin knows a handwriting expert in Bountiful named Leslie King, and they summon her down to church headquarters right away, and she examines the document and determines that it's possible that it's real, but she doesn't make a conclusive statement because she's not really in a position to. She doesn't have counter documents to really compare it to. The information that she has is limited. I think she did have some signatures to compare, but she comes out and says that it's possible that this is a real document. So at this point, the church is, in my opinion, in a really high pressure situation, both legally and in terms of public relations. And I don't know which one you want me to go through first, because
Well, we'll start with the procedural stuff and then we'll talk about how it affected the public
okay.
relations because I think that's easier to track the thesis of your
All right.
paper.
To his credit, Curtin recognizes that there's a pretty significant legal issue here. And that is in Nevada, and I think most jurisdictions, if you're in possession of an original will when a person dies, you have an affirmative duty to lodge that with the court. And in Nevada, it's 30 days. And the reason this rule exists is because, number one, we want to make sure that nothing happens to that document, that it gets lodged with the clerk of the court, because the longer it's out floating around, whether it's Howard Hughes or just some random person, there's a greater risk that it's lost or destroyed or altered or in some way compromised. And then the second reason is if you die without a will, your estate passes by what we call intestacy. And that is the statutes in any given state that give to members of your family in a way that feels as like an intuitive default. So these statutes say, well, if someone had created a will, who would they give it to? And so it favors surviving spouses, children, siblings, parents, and it works its way out. And so if you don't have a will timely lodged with the court, you could theoretically have a situation where an estate is administered and distributed to intestate heirs, and the people who are designated in the will don't receive anything. And so the law imposes liability if there's some kind of problem that's created on a will that should have been delivered that wasn't. And so, even though the risk here was probably small, the consequences would have been enormous. The church had a 1/16th interest in the estate under the will, but there were other groups and people that had interests as well. The Boy Scouts of America, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the University of Texas. And if the will had been somehow lost between when it was found at church headquarters and when it was lodged with the clerk of the court, or if it had been altered in some way, or there was an allegation that it had been altered, it could have created liability for the church or other kinds of problems. And so Wilford Curtin, to his credit, takes the will, and there's a press conference. We'll talk about that in a moment. And he personally delivers it to the clerk of the court in Las Vegas. So
Yeah,
you
but he
don't,
does it the next day.
the
I mean,
next
it's
day.
one day. They get the thing examined on the 28th. The first presidency finds it on the 27th. They call him in the morning of the 28th. The afternoon he looks at the document or has the examiner do that. And then the next day he flies it to Las Vegas personally and lodges it, right?
Yeah. And in between the time when he gets it from the first presidency on the 28th and when he lodges it with the clerk of the court in Clark County, it's continuously in his possession, which is going to become very important later. And he had great foresight there and really protected the church, because whatever was a mystery about what was the chain of custody prior to the document arriving at the church, it was unassailable where the document was and how it was kept between the time it showed up on Hyman's desk on the 27th and the time it was lodged with the clerk of the court on the 29th. And so there was discovery later that asked, I think, natural questions about the chain of custody while it was in the church's control. But there was never any kind of question or assertion or even implication that the church mishandled the document. Curtin did it perfectly. You couldn't have handled that situation better than he did. He did a great job. And so, to me, that's interesting as a probate nerd, and I think it's important to point out to the public why that's so important, why Curtin would be so rushed, and why he personally did it, and why he had that document with him in his possession the entire time for that 48 hours, or however long it was probably a little less than 48 hours. Anyway, so that's the first legal issue that they dealt with. And then the second one was more of a public relations call. And the chair of our panel pointed out, I have not verified this, but I'm sure he's right, that the church public relations department was established in 1972. So it was fairly new at this point. And as I mentioned, prior to this document showing up at church headquarters, there was already several weeks of really intense media coverage about speculation as to Howard Hughes's estate. And so the church had a sense that there was going to, it was explosive to say that they had this document. And that's why they were worried about it being a hoax, not because they were worried about the money. They didn't want to be tied to a fraud, and be used as the front for a fraud. And so they held a press conference, and I think it was a pretty remarkable press conference. They announced it without stating what the purpose was, but there were already rumors flying around that they had the will, and they came and were fairly candid with the press about what had happened. They disclosed the names of everyone who had seen the document and touched it. It was the individual I had mentioned, the Hyman, Alleman, who opened the envelopes. Martin Wendell Ashton opened it. He's Marvin J. Ashton's brother, and then President Kimball had handled it. And so the press then becomes very hungry for more, I guess the way I would put it. And they demand to speak with Alleman because she'd open the envelope. And the guy that's running the press conference, Jerry Cahill, says, "Okay, I'll go get her," which I think is remarkable in real time. So they went down the hall or called up to the 25th floor. They said, "Nola, you need to come down." So she comes down and she starts answering questions. And they begin to ask her, "Is there a dollar amount?" And at that point, Jerry Cahill cuts her off and says, "We just don't want to disclose the contents of the document at this time." But other than that, they were fairly forthright about it. And I look at that and I think the strategy was that they wanted to control the way that the document was presented to the public in terms of the church's role as a brief custodian. And my thesis in my paper is that by choosing to be forceful about controlling that, they fused the Mormon identity to the document. That was kind of the trade-off. Because if you go back and you read all of the articles in the New York Times and in other national outlets, it's always referred to as the Mormon will, every time. Even though later the church wasn't heavily involved in the litigation itself. But it's arguably a very effective move because there was never an accusation that the church was in on the hoax. And I find that to be remarkable because think about these circumstances. This will shows up at church headquarters. Nobody can explain how it got there, and the church is a beneficiary. You know, I don't think you have to have religious prejudice to look at that as an outsider and say, that's really
Fishy.
suspicious.
Yeah,
Right?
fishy. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the risk that they faced, and they really did avoid it. You know, you and I were talking briefly the other night about how would that play out now? And I think that's an interesting counterfactual. I've kind of thought about it for the last couple of days, and I just don't think it would have played out the same way at all. And I don't think that there would have
No.
been much the church PR department could have done. You know, I think that
Well, and
that
I think that what they couldn't have done any more than they did already, because I think because of the notoriety of the church and the fact that the church was a beneficiary and Howard Hughes had some relation with members of the church, you were going to get that they were going to the tabloids were going to come after that anyway at some point. And it's way worse
Yeah.
now, of course. I mean, most of the reporting here is pretty traditional. New York Times, you've cited, Deseret News, you've cited, and just your journalism was in a way different state in that time than it is today, for sure.
It is. It's faster, which would have, I think, resulted in more people drawing a very fast conclusion. And then, you know, we live in a time where there's just a lot more institutional skepticism. And we see that with the church and with other institutions, but especially with the church. And I think that in spite of pretty clear facts about how the document was handled, I think there would have been ongoing lingering suspicion if
Yeah,
this had
yeah.
happened now.
Way more conspiracy theories on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling it these
Right.
days.
Right. So that's kind of how the document initially emerged. And the will named Noah Dietrich as the personal representative. And this is a significant point because Noah Dietrich had been Howard Hughes's right-hand man for his businesses for many decades. However, about a decade prior, they'd had a falling out, and in fact, it had been in litigation with each other. And the nature and extent of that litigation is something that I'm not clear on because it's only referenced in the discovery going back and forth. Noah Dietrich really downplayed how big that litigation was and said they were all buddy buddy afterwards. And Noah Dietrich filed a petition almost immediately with the court here in Las Vegas asking to probate the will. Noah Dietrich was not a beneficiary, but he stood to gain from personal representative fees. So if you're a personal representative, you get what's basically a commission, a percentage of the estate. And so even a small percentage would have been a significant amount of money for Noah Dietrich. And he files the will, and almost immediately it draws contestants. And I should mention at this point, Howard Hughes's family situation made this litigation complex. He had a brother that died in childhood, but he was the only child otherwise, and he was not close to his family members. And so you have cousins or people purporting to be cousins that start pouring in and filing objections to this will. And a lot of these cousins had never met Howard Hughes, and some of them had only met him once. The one that I thought was the funniest, and I can't remember the name, but She came in and made her objection, and one of her arguments was, "This, I think this will is invalid because Howard Hughes would not have disposed of his estate this way." And then in discovery, they said, "Well, when was the last time you saw Howard Hughes?" And her answer was 1938. So she had a strong opinion about what Howard Hughes would do with his estate, but she hadn't seen him since 1938. And as I recall, it was the only time she'd ever seen him. And so there was quite a bit of messiness on the paternal side as to who even qualified as an heir and who was actually a cousin, in part because Howard Hughes's uncle had had multiple marriages and children from different marriages, and it was those people and their descendants that ended up being the intestate heirs on the paternal side. The maternal side was a little bit more clear, but in any event, there were objections made, and the church was required to provide written answers to questions that these objectors had, and a lot of them pressed the issue of any contacts Howard Hughes had had with the church, and then the history of the document in those very few days that the church had it in its possession. And the answers came from Wilford Curtin, and they were very detailed, and at no point did I ever see any document showing that the these objectors had any worries about how the church handled the document. But even now, at this point, they still had no idea where the document came from. One of the other beneficiaries, as a lot of people know, is a guy named Melvin Dummer, who was a member of the church. He had a gas station up in Willard at this point, but had lived out in Nevada, in Gab, Nevada. And so that immediately drew scrutiny. Who is this Melvin Dummer guy? Why is he getting 1/16th of Howard Hughes's estate? And the press immediately go to Melvin Dummer. They find him up in Willard at this gas station. And he tells this story that years prior, he had been out in the desert, 150 miles northwest of Las Vegas, that he'd happened to just randomly stop, and he found a haggard man on the side of the road who was disheveled and in danger. And he drove him back to Las Vegas. And at the end of the ride, the man revealed himself to be Howard Hughes. And so that was Melvin Dummer's explanation of how he could end up in this document. Where do you want me to go from there, Terry, as far as
Well,
as this goes?
ultimately it turned out that he's the one that delivered it to church headquarters. But they had to find it
Yes.
out from fingerprints. It's not like he came forward and said, "Oh yeah, I got this." I mean, at that stage, for me, the litigation starts to go off the rails
It
for
does. It does. And we should emphasize that, yes, you're right. Melvin Dummer only admitted to being the person who dropped off the envelope because he had to. Early in the litigation, Bob List, the attorney general here in Nevada, appeared and said, "I am going to be involved because I want to protect Nevada's interests," because there was a dispute with Texas about domicile that affects tax issues that we don't need to get into. But his other concern, Bob List, was that there might have been crimes committed here, fraud, basically. And so Bob List enlisted the help of the FBI to examine these envelopes, and Melvin Dummer's fingerprint was found on the outer part of the envelope. By the time this was discovered, Melvin Dummer had already given testimony under oath and had taken the position that he had nothing to do with the chain of custody. And so he destroyed his credibility. And later at trial, that became a huge problem because the proponent's attorney was in a terrible position here. He had to say that you should believe Melvin Dummer now, even though he lied earlier. In order to prove the will, he had to take that position. And as a litigator and attorney, Terry, you know that's a
Those are
tough,
tough. Those are
that's
tough.
tough. Yeah, that's tough to do.
So anyway, the judge even called him a liar at one point.
Yeah, the judge called him later when he got to trial. The other problem was Melvin Dummer, even when he was exposed on this lie, he just couldn't keep his story straight. And he frustrated Judge Hayes so much that Judge Hayes called him a liar in open court. And I don't know if that was Judge Hayes snapping or he just had enough of it, but he was really frustrated by Dummer's shifting story and explanations as to how the will showed up.
So then there were the rest of your presentation, I think we can sum it up, were some pretty unfounded allegations, serious allegations, though, against Judge Hayes, who,
Yeah,
by all accounts, was a very upstanding and not only an attorney, but as a judge and well respected in the community. And this turned out to be a blip in his professional life. Not, I mean, I don't think it damaged him permanently. But certainly it caused some disruption for a while.
he's the person that in reading this that I have probably the most sympathy for. He, as you said, he was respected in the community. He was an Air Force veteran. He had been a member of the legislature. He's the kind of person, he's kind of like you, Terry, involved in a lot of civic stuff, always involved in the community, and became a judge. And here's what happened. I'll tell you the story, because it isn't simply that the contestants of the will said you're Mormon and you can't be fair. That would be a completely ridiculous position to take. Harold Roden was the attorney who represented Noah Dietrich. Noah Dietrich's the personal representative, and he's trying to prove the will. And so Harold Roden needs to come up with some kind of explanation about how this will went from Howard Hughes to eventually the church office building, and he's got to make it credible and believable. And he's already got this problem where Melvin Dummar has been exposed as a liar about his role in the chain of custody. And so he's got this gap between Howard Hughes and Melvin Dummar. A man comes forward named Levain Forsyth, who claims that he had been a courier for Howard Hughes, not just for this will, but a secret courier for decades for Howard Hughes on many other items. And the story or the theory was that in 1972, Howard Hughes gave the will to Levain Forsyth, and then upon Hughes's death, Levain Forsyth delivered it to Melvin Dummar at the gas station in Willard, and Melvin Dummar panics, according to this theory, opens the document, reseals it by steaming it, and says, "Who do I trust? I trust President Kimball." So that's where it ends up.
Well, yeah, but there was a note inside, though, that said they found
Oh,
it at Joseph Fielding's house, which is
yes.
really kind of bizarre twist to this.
Well, there's three prophets referenced in this. So the outer envelope says
Oh,
it is
that's
addressed to
right.
President Kimball. And then there's a note saying that the will was found near the home or in the home of Joseph F. Smith. And then there's a still a note that says, "Dear President McKay," because President McKay was the president of the church at the time the document was supposedly executed. And
Oh,
so
okay.
there's three presidents of the church referenced in the envelopes and the
Yeah.
slips that come with the document, which is odd to say the
Yeah.
least. So anyway, Harold Roden, he's this testimony he needs from Levain Forsyth is really do or die for the case. It's got to be presented to the court in a way and to the jury that's credible, especially given some of the other challenges that he has. So they go take his deposition. And in so doing, part of a their conversation that wasn't under oath, and I still don't quite understand how this happened, was recorded and then transcribed by a court reporter. But in it, let me go pull up the quote if you don't mind, because I this is a place where I want to speak with precision. In it, he has this candid conversation that is disturbing. So Roden is talking to Forsyth, and he says, let me scroll down so I can get you the exact quote.
Think it's on page 15.
He's trying to reassure Forsyth that he's going to be safe offering this testimony. And he says, quote, "We can use a judge in Vegas who will protect you, who who will see to it that nothing bad happens. He's a judge extremely friendly towards us and wants that will to be admitted, and he'd welcome you with open arms. And then he goes on to promise that the judge would be, quote, like a savior, because the guy's a Mormon, and to save this for his church, talking about their interest as a beneficiary. So this ends up in the hands of Paul Fries, who represented three of these distant cousins. And Paul immediately files a motion to disqualify with the court. And as sympathetic as I am to Judge Hayes, I can't say that I would have done it differently than Paul Fries. This is a really bad look, Terry. It looks awful. And I think if you're counsel for the objectors, you have to file that. And so they do, and the matter is heard by a different judge, and that judge holds a 2-day hearing, basically a trial on whether or not Judge Hayes should be disqualified. Judge Hayes files an affidavit and testimony saying that it's just flat out false. And at the end of the 2-day trial, the other judge says, it makes kind of an interesting ruling that seems counterintuitive, but I understand even though I disagree. He said, I find that there's no evidence that Judge Hayes actually said any of these things, that the conversation took place. There's no evidence that Judge Hayes is acting in a biased manner or has acted improperly, but I'm going to disqualify him because under the law, the standard is not merely whether or not there was an actual ethics violation or an actual compromise of objectivity. It's whether there's a perception. And these allegations create the perception with the public that there is a bias and I need to protect the integrity of the judiciary. And so I'm disqualifying Judge Hayes. That was immediately appealed, and in a time frame that I find remarkable, the Nevada Supreme Court reversed it in 3 weeks. I mean, that's an insane turnaround legally, right? And so then Judge Hayes goes on to preside over the trial. Now, Paul Fries was based out of LA, and he had local counsel here, a gentleman by the name of Jerome Blute. And in going through this, I saw that last name, which is the last name of an attorney I litigate against frequently. And I said, are you related to this guy? And he said, yeah, it's my dad. So he was gracious enough to set up an interview. And I talked to Jerry Blute, and he indicated that after that motion was filed, which was not him, it was really Paul Fries, Judge Hayes called him and said, how could you do this to me? So it was pretty devastating to Judge Hayes. And one can understand why. Somebody who lives a life like Judge Hayes did has done that carefully to protect their integrity and their good name. And it means a lot to them. And so to be attacked at all is devastating. But this was on the national spotlight. I mean, you're talking about coverage in the New York Times with a reporter named Wallace Turner, who had near daily reports that he was sending to New York on
Yeah, but
this.
he did a lot of stuff on the church at the time, if I remember. He was kind of like their designated LDS reporter.
And he was all over this litigation. He covered it for them, but and then it was in the Review Journal, obviously here in Vegas. And so one can understand how upset Judge Hayes would have been. Just by the accusation, but by the amplification too, across the whole country. And so, to me, I think he's probably the most sympathetic figure I've come across. But he kept his composure, took it all the way to the end. The jury came back and found that the will was not admissible, that it didn't meet the requirements for a handwritten will in Nevada. And that was Judge Hayes's role. He went on to continue to serve on the bench until he died in 1979 from cancer. And one of the things I noted in the paper was the New York Times, when they covered it, they had a UPI story, and it was focused almost on exclusively on his role with the Howard Hughes litigation. And then the Review Journal has had a more expansive article, not just an obituary. It's got a couple of paragraphs. And then if you go on a family search, it's there. The family's focus is on his civic service, what he was like as a dad. And it's interesting to see the way that the perspective on an individual changes as you get closer to the individual. There's an elementary school about a block down the street from my law office. It's Hayes Elementary, and it's named after both Judge Hayes and his wife Karen. They were both members of the Nevada legislature at different points. They're both engaged civically, just really upstanding citizens.
To sum up, we've kind of got this theme from all of our conversation, but where else do you think this story could go and be developed a little bit?
Well, after I had finished putting the paper together, I found that Harold Roden wrote a book about the litigation, and so did Paul Fries, and I'd like to get a copy of both of those. I'd like to talk with some more of the people that are still living about the litigation, and I'd like to dive a little bit deeper in some of the mechanics of what happened at church headquarters in terms of the decision making. But I would like to develop this a little bit more and then build out a little bit more detail on both the origin of the document and then the Judge Hayes incident.
But the other thing I think it's important to note is the will was found to be not admissible. The church
Right.
did not appeal, but others did.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's important. I'm glad you brought that up. So early in the litigation, there's a procedural point where the parties have to take a position if they want to participate in the litigation over the validity of the will. But if you're not going to take a position, you can just do nothing. And the church chose to take an official position, which was, we don't have a position. And that sounds really strange, but I think there was some wise strategy behind that. By stating that we are not taking a position as to whether this is a hoax or not, they controlled how their position would be presented to the public. And that's what they did with the press conference, too. Rather than just remaining silent or passively saying they are neutral, they were forceful about it. And that's also part of what binds the Mormon identity to the will, because the church is so active and aggressive, especially with the press conference, and then later taking a forceful neutral position in the litigation. And that was one of my theses from the paper, is that this decision to be assertive about neutrality is what helped to bind Mormon identity to this. And one other little tiny footnote I should mention too, that's in the paper that I haven't mentioned, that I do think is interesting. So back when Curtin hires this
Leslie King.
Leslie King, the handwriting expert, she says it probably is valid, but she doesn't come to a conclusive statement. And Curtin, to the court and publicly, frames it very differently. Not he doesn't contradict her, but he says we think that it is
A slim chance that it's a hoax, right?
slim chance that it's a hoax, which is a different way of saying the same thing. That's a way of protecting the image of the church, in my opinion. I thought that was a fun contrast in how they both presented that.
Well, this has been a real interesting topic, and thank you for sharing. And hopefully, this was just about the same as if we were there for the presentation.
I really it was an honor to come on, and fun to see you again, Terry, after all these years.
Well, you too. And I appreciate you following the Interpreter Foundation and hope you continue to do so. Perhaps we'll have you on again as a guest. It's been terrific. I want to thank you, listeners, and join us for another episode of Interpreter Insights. But I want to thank our guest, and on behalf of Tom Grover, our guest, and myself, Terry Hutchinson, thanks for listening and joining us for this episode.